The 20th century's most honored writer, William Gass, once said in an interview, "Words are the supreme objects. They are minded things." And so they are. As pure and transcendent as any idea which ever cast a shadow in Plato's dark cave of our perceptions. But they are also pitfalls of deceit and misperception. Words bend our thinking to infinite paths of self-delusion. And the fact that we spend most of our mental lives in brain mansions built of words means that we lack the objectivity necessary to see the terrible distortion of reality which language brings. Example. The Chinese pictogram for honesty is a two-part symbol of a man literally standing next to his word. So far, so good. But what does the late English word integrity mean? Or motherland? Or progress? Or democracy? Or beauty? But even in our self-deception, we become gods. A philosopher-mathematician named Bertrand Russell, who lived and died in the same century as Gass, once wrote, "Language serves not only to express thought, but to make possible thoughts which could not exist without it. Here is the essence of mankind's creative genius. Not the edifices of civilization, nor the bang-flash weapons which can end it, but the words which fertilize new concepts, like spermatozoa attacking an ovum." It might be argued that the Siamese twin infants of word/idea are the only contribution the human species can, will, or should make to the raveling cosmos. Yes, our DNA is unique, but so is a salamander's. Yes, we construct artifacts, but so have species ranging from beavers to the architect ants whose crenellated towers are visible right now off the port bow. Yes, we weave real fabric things from the dream stuff of mathematics, but the universe is hardwired with arithmetic. Scratch a circle, and pi peeps out. Enter a new solar system, and Tycho Brahe's formulae lie waiting under the black velvet cloak of spacetime. But where has the universe hidden a word under its outer layer of biology, geometry, or insensate rock? Even the traces of other intelligent life we have found, the blimps on Jove II, the labyrinth builders, the Senescii empaths on Hebron, the stick people of Durulus, the architects of the time tombs, the Shrike itself, have left us mysteries and obscure artifacts, but no language, no word. The poet John Keats once wrote to a friend of his named Bailey, "I am certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affection and the truth of imagination. What the imagination seizes as beauty must be truth, whether it existed before or not." The Chinese poet George Wu, who died in the last Sino-Japanese War about 3 centuries before the Hegira, understood this when he recorded on his comm log, "Poets are the mad midwives to reality. They see not what is, nor what can be, but what must become." Later on his last disc, to his lover the week before he died, Wu said, "Words are the only bullets in truth's bandolier, and poets are the snipers." You see, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was made flesh in the weave of the human universe, and only the poet can expand this universe, finding shortcuts to new realities the way the Hawking Drive tunnels under the barriers of Einsteinian space-time. To be a poet I realized a true poet was to become the avatar of humanity incarnate. To accept the mantle of poet is to carry the cross of the Son of Man, to suffer the birth pangs of the soul mother of humanity. To be a true poet is to become God. I tried to explain this to my friends on Heaven's Gate. "Piss shit," I said. "Asshole, motherfucker, goddamn shit, goddamn cunt, peepee cunt, goddamn." They shook their heads and smiled and walked away. Great poets are rarely understood in their own day. The yellow-brown clouds rained acid on me. I waded in mud up to my thighs and cleaned leechweed from the city sewer pipes. Old Sludge died during my second year there. When we were all working on a project extending the First Avenue Canal to the Mid-Sump mudflats, an accident. He was climbing a slime dune to rescue a single sulfur rose from the advancing grouter when there was a mudquake. Kati married shortly after that. She still worked part-time as a crib doxy, but I saw less and less of her. She died in childbirth shortly after the green tsunami carried away Mudflat City. I continued to write poetry. How is it, you might ask, that someone can write fine verse with a vocabulary of only 9 right hemisphere words? The answer is that I used no words at all. Poetry is only secondarily about words. Primarily, it is about truth. I dealt with the Ding an sich, the substance behind the shadow, weaving powerful concepts, similes, and connections the way an engineer would raise a skyscraper with the whiskered alloy skeleton being constructed long before the glass and plastic and chrome aluminum appears. And slowly the words returned. The brain retains and retools itself amazingly well. What had been lost in the left hemisphere found a home elsewhere, or reasserted their primacy in the damaged regions, like pioneers returning to a fire-damaged plain made more fertile by the flames. Where before a simple word like salt would leave me stuttering and gasping, my mind probing emptiness like a tongue prodding the socket of a missing tooth, now the words and phrases flowed back slowly, like the names of forgotten playmates. During the day, I labored in the slime fields, but at night, I sat at my splintered table and wrote my contus by the light of a hissing ghee lamp. Mark Twain once opined in his homey way, "The difference between the right word and the almost right word is the difference between lightning and the lightning bug." He was droll, but incomplete. During those long months of beginning my contos on Heaven's Gate, I discovered that the difference between finding the right word as opposed to accepting the almost right word was the difference between being struck by lightning and merely watching a lightning display. So my contos began and grew. Written on the flimsy sheets of recycled leechweed fiber, which they issued by the ton for use as toilet paper, scribbled by one of the cheap felt-tip pens sold at the company store, the contos took shape. As the words returned, slipping into place like once scattered pieces of a 3D puzzle, I needed a form. Returning to Don Balthazar's teachings, I tried on the measured nobility of Milton's epic verse. Gaining confidence, I added the romantic sensuality of a Byron matured by a Keatsish celebration of the language. Stirring all this, I seasoned the mixture with a dash of Yeats' brilliant cynicism and a pinch of Pound's obscure scholastic arrogance. I chopped diced and added such ingredients as Eliot's control of imagery, Dylan Thomas's feel for place, Delmore Schwartz's sense of doom, Steve Thames' touch of horror, Salmad Brevi's plea for innocence, Dayton's love of the convoluted rhyme scheme, Wu's worship of the physical, and Edmund Key Ferrera's radical playfulness. In the end, of course, I threw this entire mixture out and wrote the cantos in a style all my own. If it had not been for Unk, the slumyard bully, I probably still would be on Heaven's Gate, digging acid canals by day and writing cantos by night. It was my day off, and I was carrying my cantos, the only copy of my manuscript, to the company library in the common hall to do some research, when Unk and two of his cronies appeared from an alley and demanded immediate payment of the next month's protection money. We had no universal cards in the Heaven's Gate Atmospheric Protectorate. We paid our debts in company scrip or bootleg marks. I had neither. Unk demanded to see what was in my plastic shoulder bag. Without thinking, I refused. It was a mistake. If I'd shown Unk the manuscript, he most probably would have scattered it in the mud and slapped me around after making threats. As it was, my refusal angered him, so he and his two Neanderthal companions tore open the bag, scattered the manuscript in the mud, and beat me within the proverbial inch of my life.